KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. How do you balance career and family? Can you balance career and family? We would love your input. You can call our feedback line right now, 206-685-2526, or email us weekday@kuow.org. We're going to take up that topic in a few minutes here on Weekday, and we want to hear from you. But first, a little science.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. What does laboratory hamburger meat have in common with the Mars rover Curiosity and Jeff Bezos? Of course, the answer is very little, but they are the focus of Alan Boyle's Science News Update today. Joining us in the studio is Alan Boyle. He's the NBC News digital science editor. Thanks for coming in.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
The big news this week, Jeff Bezos from Amazon buys the Washington Post. And in response to that happening, you posed this question to me. What can we learn about Jeff Bezos' journalism adventure from his space adventure?
That Jeff does a lot of things. He earned his billions with the Amazon company. And so a lot of people have been saying, well, what can you learn from Amazon that will be applied to the Washington Post? But he has a lot of other ventures as well. And one of them is Blue Origin, which is a space venture that he's been supporting for more than a decade. And the aim is to fulfill his dream of putting people in space in a more reliable, a cheaper way, and kind of opening up the solar system. And so I think that demonstrates how persistent he is and how willing he is to put up with failure or put up with the continuing expense of doing something that is pretty bold. And that carries over to Amazon, and also is probably going to carry over to the Washington Post.
And you also point out that this whole space adventure of his has been kind of quiet. It's not something a lot of people have heard of before. Do you think he'll be as silent about what's going on at the Washington Post as he is about almost everything else?
Well, that's been his MO. It'll be really interesting to see how it works with the Washington Post, because there you have a very public enterprise, and it's all about openness. And that's not really what Jeff Bezos has been about. He's been about doing things kind of quietly, not really saying much, not needing to court the press, because he's got so much money, he doesn't need to court investors or anything like that. And so his general way of doing things is to kind of work without a whole lot of scrutiny, and then kind of present this cool thing. And whether it's successful or whether it turns out to be a success or a failure, he'll talk about it after it's done rather than while it's being done.
And I also read in your article that you're the first journalist to ever get to visit the Blue Origin headquarters.
Yeah, the
down
secret
in Kent.
HQ.
How was it?
It was cool. There are lots of cool toys down there. It's not all about the toys for Blue Origin, but they do have some neat stuff, like a model of the Star Trek Enterprise that was used in the Star Trek movies, a model of the Discovery 1 spacecraft from 2001, A Space Odyssey. They've got a big 10-foot-wide revolving globe. You get the sorts of things that you expect at a dot-com, but here they're building freaking rockets. So
yeah,
that is probably the coolest thing of all.
Second career for you, maybe.
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 If this journalism thing doesn't work out.
Well, another interesting thing that happened this week. This week on Monday, the very first lab-grown hamburger was actually tasted in London.
I wish I could have been there for that. Not only for the burger, but just to experience London. It's been a while. But my colleague, Alistair Jameson, was there for NBC News, and you could kind of smell the smell of cooking meat in the room, at least. And some people actually did get a taste.
Yes. Let's listen to what their food critic on hand had to say about it.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't great. You would not eat this naked. You know, you need to have some more flavor. some salt, some ketchup, some pickles.
So not a great
kind
review.
Kind of mixed reviews, yeah. Uh-huh. Need a little salt and pepper there. The problem is that this is something that is created from 20,000 little pieces of beef muscle that have been grown in petri dishes, basically. And they haven't added fat to it. They added breadcrumbs. They added kind of egg to try to give it a little bit of texture. But it's definitely a work in progress, that's for sure. The backer of the experiment is Sergey Brin, who is one of the founders of Google, and is really sold on the idea that we have to do something to get beyond the way that meat is produced right now, because a lot of studies have shown that that's just not sustainable in the decades ahead. And Sergey also said that he didn't care for the way that cows are being treated. So animal welfare advocates probably took heart at that comment as well.
Yeah, and he's backed this venture with quite a bit of money. How much
cost? Quite a bit of money is a relative concept. It's $330,000 or 250,000 euro, which is a lot of money for me, but for Sergey Brin, who has a $25 billion fortune, it might almost be like the change that you pick up from the carpet in your car. But it's definitely something that he's going to continue to support. The people have talked about how this $330,000 burger is so much money, but this isn't the first burger that Sergey is going to be buying. It's clear that he's going to continue to support this in the years ahead.
Because they need to figure out a way to get it to taste better, for one, and also to streamline it so that it was something that could be mass produced.
Yeah, and there are also some twists in there that the muscle cells have to be grown in fetal bovine serum, which is not cool for people who want to get beyond meat. So there are some bugs still to be worked out, not just not just the taste, but other things as well.
But this burger, from my understanding, is it's not supposed to be a meat substitute for people who are vegetarians. It's supposed to be a meat substitute so that we stop eating cows so much.
Well, it's an inefficient way to get that protein. And, you know, we're hardwired, at least a lot of us are hardwired to go for the taste of meat. And so people don't think that we can become a totally vegetarian society. Now, maybe vegetarians would disagree about that. Meat substitutes are getting better and better. It might turn out that this is an experiment that really doesn't need to be pursued to its end. We'll see.
Do you think that people will ever get over the fact that a lot of people just in their gut feel that lab-grown meat is creepy?
Well, some people have pointed out that the way that livestock is raised is kind of creepy, too. So I think there's this old saying about how you don't want to see how the sausage is made. I think that would apply to lab-grown meat as well as real meat on the hoof.
So it could be too much information.
Yeah, that's right. That's
we
right.
know too much.
You don't want to look behind the curtain.
I'm speaking with Alan Boyle from NBC News Digital Science Editor. One more big thing that happened this week. 1 year ago this week, NASA's vehicle, the Curiosity, landed on Mars, the rover. I thought it would be fun to listen back to that moment.
Yeah.
The Vigil has separated. We've found the ground. Standing by for batch separation. We are in powered flight. We're at an altitude of 1 kilometer descending. Standing by for sky crane. Sky crane has started. Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
I'm fairly certain there wasn't actually heroic music playing in the background when that happened at the time. But it was quite a feat.
Yeah, that's an interesting clip that you played because for a couple of reasons. That's Alan Chen, who is one of the flight directors and was the launch commentator. And just this week, he said that there was a point when he was monitoring the signals to see how the descent was going. And there was a point where he started seeing signals indicating that the spacecraft was in danger of being lost, that it was coming down the wrong way. And so he decided to keep quiet about that for a few seconds and find out what happened. And it turned out that it was a spurious reading, that they just had a calibration error. But, his heart stopped, I think, for a little bit. And then there was another point that's not in that clip, but just a few seconds before he said, touchdown confirmed, we're safe on Mars, he said something like Tango Delta. And that was a code to the people in the room that he had seen touchdown, but there was one more step that had to happen. The sky crane had to blast itself away. You didn't want to have that big sky crane falling on the rover. And so when he said Tango Delta, that means I see that it is touchdown, but let's wait for a few seconds to make sure that everything is safe.
Mm-hmm.
So pro tip.
That is interesting. Wow, I should have pulled that clip. Well, and also, that's not in that clip. At the end of all the cheering, he does say, let's see where our curiosity will take us.
Oh, yeah.
Very cute.
Nudge, nudge.
So where did it take us? What have we learned in the year it's been there?
Yeah, the big thing is that it found in the rocks, it drilled into rocks for the first time. That's the first time that anyone has ever been able to do that sort of thing on Mars. And what it found was that the chemical signatures indicated that Mars was hospitable to life as we know it, garden variety life, billions of years ago. Now, past probes have found that there was water and it could have been a good environment for some sort of life, but the indication was that it had to be life that could survive an acidic environment. And so you had a lot of people talking about how maybe the organisms that developed on Mars had to be suited for extreme conditions. Well, these findings showed that it didn't have to be extreme conditions, that it could have been the sort of water that you could drink, and that would widen the spectrum of possibilities for life on Mars back in the old days.
What does it have planned going forward, this
rover? When they planned this mission, the big project was to go to this 3-mile-high mountain called Mount Sharp. But when they landed, they saw this interesting terrain where they found this evidence for habitable environment in the old days, which is in the opposite direction from Mount Sharp. And so they've actually taken a year-long detour to find what they found. And now they have to hustle up. They have to drive to get to that mountain. And there are many, many layers of rock on that mountainside that they can use as a book to kind of read the geological history of Mars. And so when they get to Mount Sharp, that's what they're going to be doing. That's job one.
How much time do they have?
The primary mission, you know, for the $2.5 billion, they bought 2 years, two Earth years, or that's the equivalent of one Martian year pretty much. But this rover is nuclear powered. It has a plutonium power source. And so theoretically, it could be going and going and going for decades. And the other rover that's operating on Mars, the Opportunity rover, was designed for a 90-day mission. And it's still going after almost 10 years. And so these things tend to last a little bit longer than you expect them to.
Alan Boyle is the NBC News Digital Science Editor. Thanks for coming in, giving us the science news of the week.
You bet. Thanks, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Minutes past 9 o'clock. A lot of women who left the workforce to stay home and raise children now want back in. More on that in a minute. The White House says President Obama will hold a news conference today at noon. The president's expected to talk about lots of stuff in the news lately, including the ongoing Edward Snowden NSA leak story, U.S.-Russia relations, and the recent terror and travel alerts. Live coverage of that event begins today at noon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Did you know you can name KUOW as a beneficiary in your insurance policy or individual retirement account, and you might be eligible for additional financial benefits? The next time you review your long-term financial plans, consider including KUOW. For more information, go to kuow.org/future.
69 degrees in Seattle and mostly sunny. Forecast says expect sun the rest of the day with an afternoon high of 84. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:21.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. In the 1970s, a generation of women was told that we could have it all, a great career, a family, we could bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan. A lot of younger women watched the frenzy of our complicated lives, and if they could afford to do it, they opted to stay home for their momhood. And then there are women and men who just chose to remain childless and pursue careers and have a little bit simpler sort of life. The issue of women and family, men and family, families and family, families and work, hit a couple of big media outlets this week. Time Magazine examines the childless and proud, while the New York Times Sunday Magazine revisits the lives of several affluent women who opted out of high-power careers a decade ago, only to find themselves struggling to opt back in. Are you childless by choice? Is it a choice you expect to make? Do you have the luxury to leave the workforce to raise your kids? Or maybe you've been forced out by the high price of childcare. We'd like to hear now about the choices you made when it comes to working outside the home and child rearing. Our phone number is 543-5869 or toll free 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. Greg posts on our Facebook page, which is Weekday on KUOW. I squeeze 30-ish hours into Friday, Saturday, Sunday. My wife works full-time, partly from home. I'm mainly a stay-at-home dad. We have a pretty strict budget, and we live fairly modestly. We rent. We have one car. It is hard, but not as hard as being a single parent. Those folks are superhuman. What about you? Choices you had to make to juggle family and career? Did you choose one over the other? We'd love to hear from you. 543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Judith Warner joins me now. She's the contributing writer for the New York Times and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of the New York Times Magazine story about women who've been out of the workforce trying to opt back in. And Judith, thank you for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here.
What was the original premise when you started out on this story?
I really had just become very curious to know what had happened to the women who had opted out, as Lisa Belkin described it, coining the phrase, about 10 years ago. I had written a book on the American culture of motherhood back in that same period and had talked a lot about how the ideal of the time was a form of motherhood that was completely child-centered, where women really devoted themselves body and soul to their kids. And I had interviewed a lot of women who were really striving to meet that ideal. And I was curious to know how their lives had turned out, what had happened to them, how had things changed for them with the economy having changed so much, and I thought too with the culture of motherhood having changed quite a bit since then.
How has the culture of motherhood changed since then?
Well, I find that, you know, once you started to have a lot of men losing their jobs in 2009, more men at home, more women having to be in the workforce, going back in or maybe working more hours than they were going to work because they needed to be the primary breadwinners, you started to have a bit of a falling off of the insistence upon the virtues of stay-at-home motherhood in the media. You know, around the turn of the millennium, there were a lot of stories that really made women feel like if they were going to be great mothers, they had to be at home. And you stopped really seeing stories like that. I think when it becomes impossible for even greater numbers of women to do that, I mean, it was always impossible for most women to do, then you just can't run those stories anymore. And there started to be also, I mean, it's interesting, in social science research, after decades in which social scientists had looked into the bad effects of daycare, the effects of separation for children who had working parents, there were actually researchers who were looking into the effects of sort of too assiduous mommy care. So that seemed to me to represent an interesting shift, too.
One thing that's interesting as you're speaking and in reading your article is that it seems like some of the more general societal attitudes are really influenced by the economy.
I think that's true, and that's always been true. Back when I wrote my book, Perfect Madness, I looked quite a bit at how attitudes toward motherhood had changed over the decades. I was really focusing on the 20th century. And it was true that at times when jobs were tight, let's say, women might be encouraged to go home, let's say, in the early 90s, there were various points in time where it became more or less socially desirable to have women working or not working, or necessary or not necessary to have them working, and attitudes toward motherhood would go along with it. Very often people would do what they did for economic reasons, and then there would be a whole slew of sort of social justification that came afterwards.
Judith Warner is speaking with me. She's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of a story that appears in this coming Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's profiles of essentially three women who have chosen or tried to opt back into the workforce after a period of time, about a decade out of the workforce. And I was also interested, in addition to money, oh, it sounds like you're out in a siren area there. In addition to money, there were family tensions that came into play with these families, between the husband and wife.
Absolutely. I mean, what would end up happening is, among pretty much all the women who I spoke with, and I spoke to about 24 women, we just focused tightly on three in the story, they would really find that there was a real slide into traditional gender roles once they left the workforce. You know, these weren't women who were necessarily traditionalists to start out with. You know, they didn't do what they did because they felt it was what, you know, a woman should be doing with her life. It was really just what they wanted to do, what they felt they needed to do. And there would be this slide into more traditionalism where they would be responsible not just for the children but also for their homes. And their husbands would get used to it and would like that. I mean, who wouldn't like not having to do the laundry? And this was really difficult for some of the women because it was really at odds with how they viewed themselves and how they viewed their marriages and what they wanted their lives to be like, and also where their talents were, for that matter.
Because all three of these women were professional women. They were in a sort of upwardly mobile career before they had opted out. You focus on a certain segment of the population. But I'm wondering, because you talked to a lot of people who you didn't profile as well, if there are any generalizations that you can make or anything that really surprised you in these conversations.
What surprised me, and you're absolutely right, by the way, we're talking about a small sliver of the population. You know, the number of women who can afford to make these kinds of choices is very, very small. And yet, this is a population that has fascinated us for a long time and continues to fascinate us for a number of different reasons. But what surprised me in hearing the stories, especially at the beginning, was how easy it was for some of them to get back in. Because I had seen the research. Sylvia Ann Hewlett had done very wide-ranging research looking at thousands of women who had taken similar steps, and they had a hard time getting back in. The women who I first reached especially did not have a hard time. They basically, after their years up, picked up the phone, went right back in. And I really wondered why. And as I spoke to more and more women, I could see the pattern emerging. The women who were the wealthiest, who had the best social connections, either because they had them before or because of connections they made in their years out while volunteering, and who had the most sort of prestigious academic and professional backgrounds, had an easy time of it. But everyone else found it pretty tough. And so it really kind of was a microcosm of what's happened in our society over the past 10 or 15 years, where the very wealthy have really pulled apart from everyone else, not just in wealth, but also in the sorts of life experiences they have.
Mommy opt-in. Well, Judith Warner, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about your article.
I was so glad to do it, and I apologize for the background noise.
Oh, I know that you're in Europe, so I hope you enjoy the rest of your time there. Judith Warner is author of an article that appears in this Sunday's edition of the New York Times Magazine. It's about women who've chosen to opt back into the workforce after some time at home to raise their children. We'd like your stories. Perhaps you were as high-powered as some of the people that Judith Warner talked to, but maybe you're like the rest of us. You had a job, you tried to figure out if you had enough money to pay for childcare, or maybe you chose not to have kids because career was important for you. We want to hear from you. 543-5869, 1-800-289-5869.
Degrees and mostly sunny in Seattle.
Scottish actor David Tennant doesn't think acting is all that hard.
You stand in a field with some cameras pointing at you, pretend to be someone else and recite words that somebody wrote in their room several months before. If you look at it objectively, it can feel a bit daft.
David Tennant on his latest role in the BBC crime drama Broadchurch, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Condo Internet, a local internet provider offering gigabit speed since 2008. Services available now in the Puget Sound area. Information on coverage areas available at condointernet.net.
It's 9:31. Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S. and Russia need to talk, especially about Syria, despite recent conflicts in the relationship. We'll have more on that in the news at 10.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Have you had to worry about balancing family and career? Is it a choice that you expect you are going to have to make? New York Times Sunday Magazine features a big article about three women who opted out a decade ago who are trying to opt back into the workforce. Time Magazine this week profiles women and men who've chosen to remain childless because they don't want to have to make that decision between career or family. They want to do one really well. We'd like your experiences. We want to hear from you. 206-543-5869. Sharon writes, I was very fortunate to have found a great opportunity when our kids were growing up. Not being a believer in having someone else raise our kids, my husband and I agreed I should stay home. When our youngest was four, I found a volunteer position available to learn to transcribe books for the blind. I went through the course required and I stayed at home. I was able to take the kids to school, work flexible hours at my office, then pick the kids up. I volunteered at school when I needed. 24 years later, I own the business producing Braille for many clients across the country. Sharon, you are indeed lucky. We'd like to hear from you, 543-5869, or toll-free 1-800-289-5869. Anna's at Seattle Center this morning listening to this conversation. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us a bit about your experience, Anna.
Well, I had my first son while living abroad in Germany, and at that time, I was working for an American company, and I didn't know what my leave options were, and I started looking into it, and I was able to take up to 3 years off, not paid the entire time, but the first year was paid, and then I decided to come back to the U.S. and take and have my second son. And I started looking into leave options here, and it varied. Every company offered some different policy, and my company was very generous, but it was only 4 months, which seemed really short after taking that year in Germany. And when I started exploring what one needs to do to stay at home just a little bit longer, it's pretty complicated. And I talked to coworkers, and it's basically either default to your company policy or become a stay-at-home mom. And I didn't really start my career wanting to give it up. Hmm. And so I just wanted a little bit more time.
So it's interesting. It's a difference in public policy, how different governments, how different societies view motherhood and career.
Exactly. And I felt like in Germany I didn't have to make that choice between career and raising my family. But it became very apparent here. It was sort of a one and the other.
Huh, that is an interesting whole facet of the conversation that I hadn't really thought we'd get into, but I'm really glad that you called in, Anna, and thanks so much for participating. We are talking about raising a family, having a career, maybe like Greg, who posted on our Facebook page. He stays home. His wife works full time. There's a lot of different arrangements that people have made. We want to hear about your choices. 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday@kuow.org. Erin in Sammamish, you are on the air. Hi.
Hi. I decided to opt out when my children were born and took 7 years off from the workplace. And I had a very high-paid career before that. I was a consultant for PricewaterhouseCoopers and realized coming back that I really didn't want to have the kind of pressure as far as travel and hours that that type of career would have. And so I started my own business. I now sell chocolate that I make at Indy Chocolate at a Pike Place Market out of my store there. And it's been a really good, it was really nice to take the time off and really have the time with my children when they were so young. But when they went back to school, I really found that I needed something.
So how old were they when you formed this business, Erin?
When I formed my first business, my youngest had just started kindergarten. She was 7. And when I started Indy Chocolate, my own company locally, She was 10. My youngest was 10. Hmm.
So you were home with them when they were preschool age, up till school?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, until the youngest was in kindergarten.
Well, Erin, thanks for sharing that story with us. We're going to let you go because your cell phone is a little hard to hear. Essentially, what I'm hearing from you and from Anna is that there's a desire to stay home when the kids are little, and then for a lot of women, once school starts, you are yearning for a little bit more. There's a lot of women who become involved with their kids' schools and spend the time working on the PTA, volunteering for the many committees. I know my son's school had all of that as well, and it is a hard balance. We want to know if you made that choice or chose not to make that choice. Rachel, on Vashon Island, you chose not to have kids.
That's correct. I chose that for multiple reasons, but one of the features of my life without kids is that my career is a very large part of my life. I have a life outside of work, but it doesn't include kids. And my mom made a different choice. She was a baby boomer and chose kids, and I think that part of her career path choice was a career path that was supportive of being very involved and very close to her kids. So, you know, having kids was hugely important for her and her identity, and I think that's wonderful, but it means that we have there's kind of a gulf between her understanding of and mine about kids, and it's an interesting perspective to hear from your author that makes a huge difference in how everybody feels about themselves or about people that are close to them.
It's fascinating. I'm really glad you chose to call in, Rachel, and thanks for taking a few minutes with us. Rachel on Vashon chose to not have kids because she wanted to pursue her career, caused a bit of a riff with her mother. Maybe you are put in the position right now of trying to decide. Maybe you haven't yet started a family. Maybe you're trying to figure out if that really is the route you want to go. Or maybe you're somebody like me whose child is just about to leave home and you're about to enter another phase of your life. Now that my child rearing days are behind me, I'm like, oh, really? That's back to the beginning. 543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Anne in Ballard writes, I had my first child when I was teaching at a charter school in Oregon. I tried going back to work for one more year, but it was the hardest year ever. It did not make financial sense paying someone else to raise my child while I barely made enough money to make it worthwhile. I also hated not being able to give 100% to neither my daughter nor my job. Leaving work was the easiest decision I ever made. I don't regret it one bit. Maybe you did leave home, like some of the people in Judith Warner's New York Times Sunday Magazine article, and you are going back not to the high power career that you left, but you're looking at something else. Erin in Sammamish started a business when her kids went to school. What about you, Allison, on Bainbridge? You left a high power job.
Yeah, I worked for one of the large corporations in Seattle and was traveling a lot, and my husband and I really wanted to start a family, and I looked at our work and our lives, and it didn't feel like I could have the balance I looked for, so I ended up actually leaving the corporate world and going to the nonprofit world and found that gave me the balance I needed, the flexibility in my career, and some space to actually be able to have both a working life that was very fulfilling as well as raising my children.
Did you take a period of time off before you chose a different work path?
I didn't. You know, I went right from the corporate world to the nonprofit world, and thankfully, financially, we had the flexibility to do that because I know that was a big consideration for us. After our first child, I went right back to the nonprofit. We had a second child who had some health issues, so I had to stop working at that point. And took a few years and did not work. And when I was ready to reenter the workplace, what I found was actually that the nonprofit world was very open to having a mom who'd been out of the work world for a few years. And the first opportunity that I explored as an executive director, I was able to step into. So it's been, it's really opened my eyes to what's possible for working moms. And I've actually hired a number of women who have been out of the workforce up to even 10 or 15 years into the nonprofit world, and they have been amazing employees and have stepped right back into their lives as working women.
Allison, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. One of the things that Judith Warner points out in her New York Times Magazine article is that in the decade that the women she profiles have been out of the workforce structure has changed because the economy has changed, and where they couldn't work part-time before, there are a lot more flexible options available because, in fact, many companies are looking to hire part-time people. Stephanie writes, I honestly thought I would be able to keep up with my job after my first child was born, and with help from my husband and hiring a nanny, I could. When I was expecting my second child, my nanny informed me her rate would double. My hourly wage did not. I do not regret taking care of my kids, but legally and monetarily, I might as well have died. I have no social security history, no credit history, no recent employment history. What about you? We'd like to hear about choices you made, family versus career. Did you opt out of the workforce to raise your children? Was that a good situation for you? Maybe you were somebody who couldn't make your salary cover the childcare costs. It didn't make economic sense. I think that's true for a lot of people these days. Or maybe you went home and being a homemaker just wasn't it. Vicki and Everett, it sounds like that might have been a little bit like your story.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for the topic. So part of it is the economy. We were military, so took on those traditional gender roles because he was traveling and away so often. With the divorce that followed, though, I was involved and informed financially, but it really took a hit on my retirement and savings. So I was then a single parent. I went back to grad school to update my skills. At the time, the economy turned, so I was unemployed for 3 years. I'm now back at work for $12 an hour. And I'm looking at being that older female living in poverty, and I never expected that. Hmm. I spent my retirement, I spent a lot of savings, had to cash in and at loss because of the economy to secure housing. Otherwise, I'd have been I wouldn't have had a housing.
Wow. Oh, Vicki, thank you for sharing that story. Hard choices that Vicki had to make. And we haven't talked about divorce and single parenthood a whole lot. We had an emailer earlier who said he's the stay-at-home dad, and it's a whole lot easier than being a single parent. Jerry in Freeland made a similar choice. He says, my wife and I have had an unusual working family life for the last 22 years. After our oldest daughter was born in 1991, my wife went back to work, and I was primary care, playmate, and daytime diaper changer. I'm an artist, and I could adjust my schedule around sleep and awake times. That lasted through their high school, where in the younger years, I'd see the kids off in the morning and meet them coming home. Having both daughters in school did make it easier to work. Even now in our lives, my wife has had to take a job in Eastern Washington. She lives in the Tri-Cities. Our youngest daughter's home after freshman year of college at home with me. I've been the primary caregiver, cook, comforter, and listener for 22 years. The hardest part has been the lack of acceptance by other moms and fathers who have outdated beliefs in the traditional roles for husband and wife. How have you made career and family work for you, single parents, careers like Jerry and his wife have? We want to hear from you. 543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Hi, Karen on Capitol Hill. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing for over 30 years, and my daughters are ages 28 and 26 now. So have been doing the work-life balance thing for my entire career. And I would like to make the point that people need people and businesses, but also the parents and families themselves, need to think outside the box and about what it means to be an effective professional, a good employee, and a good parent. Because I was able to take off 3 to 4 months with the birth of each child. But I then continued working part-time at a time when doing so as a lawyer was really not cool, was not valued. But I've had a marvelous career. I did not lose my professional skills, and nor did I stop doing the part-time work when the kids went to school. Frankly, when your children are teenagers is when you'd better be keeping an eye on what's going on and just be hanging around. Otherwise, there can be trouble. So it's the parent who wants to stay home when the child is little, but it's the kid who needs more attention when they are somewhat older.
But you had the luxury of being able to work part-time, right?
Well, luxury, but I thought it is a luxury to me, but I fought very hard for that right and insisted. And I made sure that my skills were, I had a niche skill, and my employer recognized that if they let me go because of child care issues, they were going to have to spend a lot of money on outside counsel.
Yeah.
But as now, I'm a shareholder, I'm a partner in a law firm, and it's very important to me in the boardroom to be making decisions that allow the younger women to both pursue their careers effectively and professionally and also have the option to raise children.
Karen, thanks for bringing that up. Appreciate your call. Jessica follows up on that as well. She emails, the real question is, why are there so few options for a professional life that does accommodate family life? I had a successful career, she writes, before a recent relocation. Now I'm unemployed. I'd love to find a job, but there are very few options that will allow me to tend to my preschooler and my home while my husband also works a very demanding job. It's an interesting question we're asking today, how you balance work and family. If you choose to balance the two, maybe you've chosen one over the other. Maybe staying home has been very fulfilling for you. We'd love to hear from you at 206-543-5869. Karen in Bellevue, thanks for joining us. Karen?
Yes.
You're on the air.
I just read Sheryl Sandberg's book. I think that's her name, the COO of Facebook. And I think she makes such an important point about who your partner is. It seems like most of this conversation presumes there's the husband primary breadwinner with his demanding job, and then how do I get my job to be less demanding so I can accommodate taking care of children as well. And I think a big conversation is, how do women and wives push back on their husbands and the demands of their careers so the family can accommodate both parents having careers and both parents participating in child care and home responsibilities. In my own personal marriage, that was a discussion and a fight because it was pushing against traditional expectations that, you know, the husband's resume or his income earning or profession is of primary importance, and then the wife fits in what she can. And I pretty much had to fight for equal consideration of my career, equal participation from my husband in child rearing. And I think it was worth the fight because we were both able to maintain good careers, and he's an extremely active and equal participant in child care and raising our kids.
Karen, thanks for that call. We did hear from a couple of men who are stay-at-home dads who have done the primary child-rearing functions that traditionally fall to women. But it is a conversation that a lot of people have been able to successfully navigate with their spouses of same-sex, opposite-sex, however you configure your family. And right now, we're looking at choices that make it work for everybody. Elizabeth in Wallingford joins us now, and you are not a parent at this point, Elizabeth.
Oh.
You need to turn down the radio.
I apologize for that. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So, I feel like I'm a little different than a lot of the callers that you've had. I'm a lot younger. I'm in my early 20s. And I'm just starting my career. What's happening for me and, you know, a lot of the women around me is because college was so difficult to get through in the, you know, late 2000s, and we're just now starting our careers. We're not being paid really a living wage yet, and we won't be for more than a decade, and it doesn't feel hopeful. I think a lot of us are opting out of having children. Not really, it doesn't feel like a choice. It's almost sort of like a bitter disappointment that we don't think that you can have it all. And it's, it's almost sort of a sad turn of events for us.
So do you want to have children?
I think, you know, it sounds cliche, but if the circumstances were exactly right, that might be a choice that I would really consider. But right now I almost push it out of my head deliberately because I know, you know, I can barely afford
my apartment. I can barely pay my phone bill. I can barely, you know, take care of myself. How could I take care of a child? And it's, yeah, it's scary to think if I put someone else in my life like that, that it would be just that much harder.
Thank you for calling. I appreciate your perspective on this. Elizabeth doesn't actually know what her path will be right now. She's just trying to get her career established. We've heard from a lot of people who have been in the workforce for a while, have gone to part-time work. Maybe their husbands or partners have done a good share of the child rearing. Iris writes, as I near my 35th birthday and in a heterosexual marriage, my husband and I have decided not to have children. As a result, I have the freedom and luxury to focus on my career. I'm in the process of moving up in my career, and I've noticed that the positions I'm interested in ask for a flexible schedule to include occasional evenings and weekends. I have many professional friends who work very hard to find the balance with children and home life. As a result, I feel very fortunate to no longer have to worry about making such choices. My hat's off to all dedicated parents who work full-time. I really don't know how they do it in a society that does not honor parenthood, particularly does not honor motherhood. I'd like to thank all of you who we managed to talk with for sharing your stories with us. As mentioned, this is in the air right now. Time magazine has an article that examines people who've chosen to be childless, like Iris. And this coming Sunday, the New York Times Sunday Magazine revisits the lives of several affluent women who opted out of high-power careers a decade or so ago, only to find themselves struggling to opt back in. You can continue to post your stories at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW at Facebook. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
That's Nutmeg. She's a 14-year-old Cocker Spaniel, and she's sniffing the floor for puppy treats. Now, yesterday, if you recall, if you were listening, you heard chimpanzees going ballistic over their food. Nutmeg is a lot more subdued. Her owner, Mark, who sent us the sound, says Nutmeg doesn't see very well anymore, and she can't hear very well. But as you can hear, the sniffer still works incredibly well. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds of what you hear and then send that to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. Well, the sound of the day today may still be splashing at local beaches and swimming pools, because right now when I look up, it's 71 degrees and sunny in Seattle's University District. It is Friday, and it's time for a weekend forecast from Washington State climatologist Nick Bond. And Nick, are you hearing splashing outside your window?
Well, not quite yet, but certainly this afternoon it'll be appropriate for that. We're looking for mostly sunny skies, low 80s. There'll be some high-level clouds moving in from the southeast at times from a disturbance to the south. But today's going to be a good day. The weekend, maybe a little bit of a different story.
What are we expecting?
Well, tonight starts the threat of some showers from kind of thunder showers drifting off the Cascades into the lowlands of Puget Sound, especially in the southern part of Puget Sound. I think the there is a threat late tonight into Saturday, but Saturday afternoon should be just kind of partly cloudy with upper 70s. It's kind of a fool's game to try to pinpoint when these showers are and where they're going to occur. And so I'm ideally suited to play it, of course. But the highest threat for the soaking rains looks to be late Saturday night into Sunday morning. And Sunday looks like a little bit of a cooler day yet, with low to mid-70s, mostly cloudy. Plenty of rain up in the Cascades, so if you're going camping there, your rain fly should be in good working order.
And is this rainy, cool weather, relatively cool weather, going to stick with us past Sunday, do you know?
Well, Monday, everything should be winding down. And for much of next week, it should be kind of the standard issue weather, upper 70s with morning clouds and mostly sunny afternoons. And, you know, have you heard that one before?
Yes, I have. Well, we've had, you know, big spate of summer. But one thing that I've noticed recently, very recently, like the past few days, is a bank of fog that comes in from the west, winds directly out of the west in the early morning. As I've mentioned to you before, I'm outside pretty early in the morning. And are you guys, you forecaster, climatologist guys, able to tell us how those ocean breezes are affecting our inland weather yet?
Well, that's a really tricky part of it. And because it makes all the difference just how thick that marine layer is and how kind of how far it pushes in to what our days are like. And so very subtle differences in the pressure patterns and the winds can mean that the clouds are gone by early morning and, you know, mostly sunny day with warmer temperatures versus one that stays cloudy well into the afternoon. And so that's kind of a tricky part, and then to a certain extent have to still just kind of wait and see.
Hmm. I know that you're kind of excited about a new kind of seasonal forecasting system that is coming online.
Yes, it's called J-Scope. And while it might sound like an uncomfortable medical procedure for men over 50, or maybe an ongoing effort to keep track of what our governor is up to or something, it actually stands for JASAO's Seasonal Coastal Ocean Prediction of the Ecosystem. And we're doing a kind of a soft launch now. It's on a public website, and there'll be a press release, I think, next week. The whole idea here is we're trying to anticipate what is liable to happen in the coastal waters of the Pacific Northwest with lead times of 6 to 9 months.
Hmm.
And you might think this is of academic concern, but if you're a fish or you like to catch or eat fish, it does matter.
And I'm sure the people who catch and eat the fish will be looking at it, and probably not the fish themselves.
Yeah, that's right, of course. And this is all under the auspices of an integrated ecosystem assessment by NOAA's Northwest Fisheries Science Center. And what we're doing here is just kind of leveraging off some activities that are being done for seasonal weather prediction. And in particular, we're taking the global climate model that's run for that out 9 months every day and embedding an ocean, high-resolution ocean model for the Pacific Northwest coastal waters to see what's, you know, happening on the details there, the chemistry and the plankton and so forth. And here I really want to give credit to Samantha Sadlecki at JASAO, who's doing all the heavy lifting and running the model and verifying it and so forth.
Well, I hope it works out, and I'll just look to the west for my own weather and hope that I'm not going to see too many clouds, at least for the next couple of weeks. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Looks like tomorrow will be the better of the two weekend days. Coming up on Weekday, our journalist roundtable, talking over the elections and more here on KUOW.
A rapidly spreading wildfire in Southern California has now destroyed at least 10 homes and is threatening hundreds more. That and more of today's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
For singer-songwriter Valerie June, finding her voice meant listening to the many that are in her head.
It kind of sounds crazy, you know, to say, hey, I hear an older black male voice. Sometimes I hear a younger woman's voice. Sometimes I hear a child's voice.
Valerie June's new album, Pushing Against a Stone, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.